The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. Great Monday weather-wise here in Northern California. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. And we have an interesting program for you. Let me run through the announcements as quickly as I can. Please jot down our toll-free number. It is 1-866-687-7223. Your calls are welcome. No call screeners. Let the phone ring. And we'll get you up on air with our guest today as quickly as possible. Do remember that we will hold you over the break if that's relevant, or we may just extend and not take the break. And we also do answer the phone on the toll-free line during the break. So again, it is 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And do go to the website, and our comprehensive newsletter is there for the week. It has all of the details of the programs for the week. If you go over to the far right and scroll down a little bit, you'll see upcoming shows. Remember, when a show is listed there, you can start posting comments or questions or whatever you would like on the blog, which is part of that show. Just scroll down once you open it up, and you'll see this place for you to post away. And you can post before, during, and, of course, after the live show ends. So do check that out. There's also another menu up in the upper left-hand corner, and there's websites and other places and information of interest to you there. Plus, our streaming sites are located there. And our Cafe Press logoware store is there under the support menu. So we've expanded it, new items. They all have the new Space Show logo on it from our Indiegogo campaign a year ago this time. So check it out, and hopefully you'll find some items of interest. And if you have suggestions, I'm certainly happy to hear from them. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can listen off of our site or easily and quickly download these programs. And then I guess the most important thing is for me to remind everybody that we are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we exist, we survive, because many of you do financially support us with your gifts, and we thank you very much for that support. Remember, as a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, your gift on the federal level, if you pay federal taxes, is tax deductible. And if you are a California taxpayer, since we're a California public benefit corporation, your gift is tax deductible against your California taxes as well. Check out our website for more information. Also, our parents' website, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to actually email and download our Space Show programs. They're about 25 megabytes in size, or, of course, you can send the URL to people. We do want you to spread the word, so we're fine with you doing either one. There are a few rules. Don't do anything commercial with the shows. Don't edit them and then put your edits, cuts, or clips up on YouTube or any other website. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. Remember, our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our spaceshow.com website pages, as well as every one of our onegiantleapfoundation.org website pages. If you have any questions, or you're just chomping at the bit to take an edit off of a space show program for some reason, email me for permission. Let's see if we can work it out. We appreciate your doing that. We do have new sponsors. Their ads go across the front page of our website. Take some time every once in a while to click on them and see what the companies are doing. We wouldn't be giving you these shows free of charge were it not for these sponsors and those of you that do financially support us. We'd either be long in history off the air, or the only way you would get the shows would be through a subscription membership program. So because of our nonprofit status and our donors and our sponsors, we are able to distribute the content for free, but we certainly need your support to be able to continue to do that. For the sponsors, for the first segment of today's show, two of our sponsors are bringing us this first segment. Celestis is one sponsor, and they are, of course, the global premier service for space memorial services. And their announcement for today is called A Shooting Star in Final Tribute. In June of 2012, Celestis' last memorial spaceflight carrying the ashes of 320 people into Earth orbit, it went, re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, blazing like a shooting star in the final tribute to those on board. The flight began earlier in the year with a dramatic nighttime liftoff from the Cape. The launch location of Celestis' next Earth-orbiting mission, currently scheduled later for this year. The people on that 2012 flight included Mercury 7 astronaut L. Gordon Cooper, Star Trek actor James Doohan, who played Scotty on Star Trek, and hundreds of people from various walks of life around the world, including my mother and two of my dogs. While the 2012 mission orbited a little over a month, Celestis' next Earth orbit mission is designed to orbit over the planet for 5 years, joining two other Celestis spacecraft currently orbiting Earth. Space on board is limited, so if you have a loved one who you would like to memorialize in this way, contact them, celestis.org. And then AIAA is a sponsor, and that is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They're the world's largest professional society. They have more than 30,000 engineers and scientists from 88 countries dedicated to the aerospace profession. They convene 5 yearly conferences a year. They call them forums now. They have over 150,000 technical papers. They develop and maintain standards, honors, and they celebrate achievement, and they advocate for specific policy issues. So do check them out. They are an incredible organization, AIAA.org. And then that brings me to our guest for today, so I'm happy to welcome again, because he's been a previous guest on the show, Scott Lowther, and he received his degree in aerospace engineering from Iowa State back in 1996, and he got his first job in the industry at Orbital Sciences, designing the thrust structure for the X-34B, but the X-34B was canceled the week after he got there, so then they canceled him. From there, he went on to Pioneer Astronautics rocket plane in Colorado, then United Technologies Chemical Systems Division in California, then ATK in Promontory, Utah. He's been interested in aerospace design and history for as long as he can remember, and he has focused his attention on things that did not get built, the concepts that failed for whatever reason, and the concepts that formed the evolutionary line from conception to completion for successful aircraft and spacecraft. He started writing and editing Aerospace Projects Review in the late 1990s in response to hearing some shocking tales of companies that of archives being thrown out, shredded, and incinerated. While he has overall general interest in things unbuilt, he has particular loves, including the X-20 Dinosaur and the nuclear bomb-powered Project Orion, which he is going to talk about today. But first, I'd like to welcome Scott back to the show. How are you, Scott?
Doing okay today.
When you were at Pioneer Astronautics, was Zubrin there at the time, or Mitch?
Yes.
Clapp?
Yes.
Was Mitch there too?
No. Well, he was. They were part of the same team, but Mitch was in another state.
But this, you were there during the days of Zubrin.
Yes.
So you got to know Bob, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not for today's show, but that's an interesting story about that company.
Yeah.
And but we'll leave it, because they weren't doing anything with nuclear power, were they?
No, we wanted to, but for some reason, the Department of Energy wouldn't give us any nukes to play with.
Well, that hasn't changed, and here we are in 2016, going on 2017. Anyone going to give you some nukes to play with?
Well, there's always the North Koreans. You know, if you got money, I'm sure they can give you a nuke.
Well, do they work?
Well, they got H bombs that
they say they do.
Yeah, that put out a whole, you know, 5 kilotons. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, they say they do. They say they have them in the size of a brief. Look, you can probably get them from Iran. They're probably further along anyway.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, if you really want nukes these days, the place to go would be to Russia. Because we know they've got nukes that work. And
but do they sell them?
They're probably not real happy about the idea of selling them, because they know that if they sell somebody a nuke and that somebody uses it on somebody else, that somebody will figure out it was the Russians. And
yeah, they could trace it back to them.
Yeah, bad things will ensue.
Well, there's probably a couple of foundations out there that could broker that deal for you.
Yeah, it's a Spectre organization I've heard good things about.
That's right. They just had another film about them a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So what's the latest on our evolution toward any form of nuclear power for space access or space use?
Oh, the latest?
Yeah. Is it going to happen? Is it never going to happen? What's your call?
Well, unless things incredibly change in the United States on a political and sociological level, I don't see the United States officially doing anything nuclear, with any form of nuclear propulsion, in my lifetime. That said, Elon Musk has expressed considerable interest in using nuclear propulsion for trips to Mars and nuclear power plants on the surface of Mars. Anything Elon Musk says he wants to do, I wouldn't put it past him being able to do it. I just suspect he will have to go outside the United States to actually get that done. And there we go, kind of back to the Russians.
I would think so, but he has a way of fulfilling what he says he's going to do. So
yeah.
Well, I wouldn't discount it, but I wouldn't hold your breath.
Yeah. Yeah, the Russians have, well, they had the technology, and they had the expertise, and they've probably got the will, they just don't have, you know, the money. Whereas Elon Musk, he's lacking the infrastructure, so far as I know, unless his Hugo Drax division is further along than anybody suspects.
His what?
Hugo Drax.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, that's obscure.
Yeah, that'll be lost on several people, but that's okay.
I would suspect the biggest stumbling block to an American billionaire going to Russia and telling the Russians, I want, you know, a 150-kilowatt nuclear reactor for the surface of Mars or the Moon or wherever, such as the, you know, the former Soviet Topaz reactors, the biggest stumbling block would not be the technology or even the money. I suspect it would be the various governments involved. I don't imagine the State Department would be too thrilled with the idea of American civilians, you know, buying nuclear reactors, you know, especially from the Russians.
Well, I don't think so either, but I think the issues are more on the policy side than they are technical or even money.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we've had the technology to do various forms of nuclear power and propulsion in space for 50 years, 60 years.
Uh huh.
You know, anything from, you know, the Russians had actual nuclear reactor powered satellites, spy satellites in orbit, and we had a couple SNAP, you know, satellites, and of course all our deep space probes up until Juno had RTGs on them. We knew how to do this. Whether or not we actually can do it is becoming a whole nother matter, and it's another matter that doesn't exactly fill me with joy.
Well, Juno went out with solar power.
Right.
But they've said that that's about the extreme right now that they could do with solar power. Anything further out would have to have an RTG on it.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in college, they were saying that they couldn't go to Jupiter with solar power. So the improvements in solar cells have made Jupiter possible. But, you know, they're getting sort of at the limit of what you can hope to accomplish with solar power from an efficiency standpoint. And if you look at the Juno spacecraft, it's a tiny little spacecraft with gigantic solar panels attached to it. So anything further than that is just going to be this monumentally vast, this football field full of solar cells with a Nikon camera in the middle, you know, attached to a walkie-talkie.
So what is your specific interest on the nuclear propulsion development, exploration, experimental side?
My particular interest is nuclear pulse propulsion in general and Project Orion in specific. And sad to say, these are not so much looking forward as looking back as at things that we could have done, and if we put our minds to it, we could do in the future.
So for listeners who don't know what Project Orion was, because you're not talking about the Orion space capsule.
Correct.
Or nuclear pulse propulsion, because as I've told you in emails, most of them hear nuclear electric or nuclear thermal. So give everyone sort of the 101 history, okay?
Okay. In general, nuclear pulse propulsion covers a wide area, and the basic idea is you set off a nuclear explosion, and the pulse, whether the radiation or shockwave from expanding propellant, actually shoves your ship forward. Now, today, when you talk about nuclear pulse propulsion being studied today, it's almost invariably what's called inertial confinement nuclear propulsion. In this case, you take a tiny little pellet, often about the size of a grain of sand, that is full of deuterium, sometimes a deuterium-tritium mix, and has an outer shell that's either solid hydrogen or maybe even glass, just depending on, you know, the various different designs. And you hit this tiny little pellet within a Death Star's worth of laser beams all at once from every direction. The outer surface of the pellet explodes because it's just been bombarded with the worst laser beam ever, and the explosion of the outer shell compresses the inner portion of the pellet hot enough and with high enough pressure that the hydrogen undergoes fusion and you get, you know, a tiny little hydrogen bomb rather than yields measured not in kilotons but kilograms. Kind of like, you know, hand grenade going off. And you do that many, 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 many times, preferably many times a second, and these tiny little bangs push your ship forward. But originally, the idea was not to use tiny little pellets and laser beams, but actual atomic bombs. Project Orion, which everybody should be aware of, but sadly most people aren't, was a project that began shortly after Sputnik in 1957. A fellow named Ted Taylor is a nuclear weapons designer in the United States. He decided that what the United States needed to respond to Sputnik wasn't another rocket shooting a, you know, grapefruit-sized satellite into orbit. What the United States needed to do was to launch an actual ship into space, not couple of pounds, but hundreds of tons, thousands of tons of vessel. And so Ted Taylor, working with a number of other people at General Atomic in near San Diego, started this project with assistance initially from DARPA and with such luminaries as Freeman Dyson, he of a legendary Dyson sphere. They spent a number of years working on the concept, taking it from vague, hand-wavy, wouldn't it be neat idea through basic math on up to detailed engineering designs and various tests, physical tests to prove out the concept. And by the time the program was unfortunately canceled in the early 60s, they had basically proven that the concept was feasible. It undoubtedly would have been a challenge to carry off in actual practice. But what they had come up with was practical designs for 4,000-ton spacecraft that would be launched by a succession of relatively small atom bombs.
How many atom bombs did they need to do that?
To launch from the surface of the Earth to orbit, which was the original intent, but which would obviously today terrify the hell out of Greenpeace and basically anybody downwind of this thing, would take about 800 bombs.
So you're talking about actually when they push the button to launch, they're doing this with from the launch on the pad. This is not activating it in space.
Correct. The original idea was to launch from the surface of the Earth, either out in the desert of Nevada, or later on the idea was to probably put a barge out in the Atlantic Ocean, so that downwind, there was nobody downwind except for thousands of miles of Atlantic Ocean. That was the original concept, was to launch from the surface. Once they realized that this would have various issues attached to it, they came up with a number of different alternatives, such as using the Saturn V and the post-Saturn vehicles that were proposed in 62, 63, to put, the spacecraft in orbit in pieces, assemble it in orbit, and then initiate it in orbit, or to have a complete vehicle and put it on top of either a cluster of solid rocket boosters or one very large liquid rocket booster and loft it, which would mean to shoot it straight up, basically. Not to put it in orbit with the chemical rocket, but to put it roughly above the sensible atmosphere and then start the nuclear pulse engine. And either of those would be, of course, far more environmentally sound than launching from the ground. But the lofting idea, which was, I believe, the most popular concept, is actually the one that's kind of the trickiest.
And what happened?
Where
does it sit today?
In
a warehouse, I understand.
Well, it sits in various archives, a couple bits and pieces here and there. The Smithsonian has one of the test articles. In essence, what happened, there was two things that killed Orion. At the end, the thing that truly did it in was the test ban treaty, 1963, which said you cannot set off a nuclear bomb in the atmosphere or in space, which kind of makes a spacecraft powered by atom bombs a little challenging to pull off. And the thing that kind of started to do in the project prior to that is a bit legendary, and nobody's entirely sure just how true this is, but the story goes that General Atomic, working for the Air Force, designed themselves a space-going battleship, a 4,000-ton vehicle that was loaded to the gills with weaponry, including 5-inch guns, U.S. Navy 5-inch guns, including turrets, and weapons, reentry vehicle nuclear weapons for surface bombardment, and weapons called Cassava howitzers, which are amazing little devices. And they designed this for the Air Force, because they thought the Air Force would love it. The Air Force apparently didn't really care. They thought it was a little too science fiction. And what really started to do them in was they showed off a display model of this, which was reportedly the size of a Corvette, a car, big enough that people could get inside it and move things around.
Uh-huh.
It was supposedly shown to John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who took one look at it and was horrified at the idea of basically Armageddon in a can. This thing would have upwards of 220 megaton bombs for the specific purpose of plastering surface targets. If nuking it from orbit is the only way to be sure, this thing would have been extremely certain of accomplishing its goals. And apparently JFK thought this was horrifying. And when the President of the United States takes a look at your baby and says, your baby's ugly, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with it, things start going downhill. And so General Atomic tried pushing their efforts from the Air Force to NASA, because even though this started off as a military project, the idea of a 4,000-ton spacecraft that could get from Earth to Mars in a single stage very quickly, you know, it would seem an obvious choice for NASA. NASA was already heavily invested in Saturn V and Apollo, and even if NASA thought that this thing would work, it would overshadow the work they were currently doing.
Well, and they were on their way to the moon by the end of the century, by the end of the decade. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So that wasn't going to happen.
And the story goes that they showed some test footage of a subscale test vehicle, a flight vehicle, what was called Putt-Putt. Think about a meter in diameter, about the size of a garbage can. They carried, I believe it was 6 or 8 small hand grenades, essentially, chemical explosions.
Uh-huh.
And that would push it up into the sky, and it actually worked. You know, it flew like a champ. And they were given a presentation to Wernher von Braun, his own self, and he fell asleep during their presentation because he thought they were nuts. And he only started to pay attention when they showed the film of this thing actually in flight. But even having Wernher von Braun suddenly decide, hey, that's not a bad idea, it was a little too late by then, and NASA was entirely too invested in Saturn and Apollo to, you know, change directions.
And here we are today in successfully married with chemical rockets and not seeming to be able to get out of that loop.
Yeah. Well, I would love to be in an alternate timeline where Orion came to pass in the 1960s and they figured out the technical issues and they figured out how to set off bombs without trashing the environment. But I'm not sure how we can get to there from where we are today. It's not that we don't have the money. I mean, we're a lot richer than we were in the 60s. It's not like we don't have the technology or the material science. We're, of course, far more advanced now than we were then. But in 1960, the United States was not only had H-bombs and atom bombs in series production. We had people whose entire purpose in life was to design new ones. And they spent their days designing new atom bombs. So they knew how to design a new atom bomb. Whereas now, we haven't designed a new atom bomb in the lifetime of many, many a career of a nuclear engineer.
Yeah, but many people probably see that as a plus in our evolution of policy to be getting away from the horror of nuclear weapons.
Well, the problem is that there's really not a replacement for something like Orion in terms of capability. I mean, if you want to send a colony to Mars, you could load up an Orion with hundreds of people and have them there in a couple of months. And they'd take all their stuff with them, cows, dogs, kitchen sinks, the work.
So you can't do that with nuclear thermal or nuclear electric?
No. You can take a nuclear electric system and load it up with a whole bunch of stuff, and years later it will creak its way to Mars. Because even though it might have nearly the specific impulse of a large Orion, it doesn't have, you know, its thrust is pitiful. Tiny, it's pathetic. Whereas Orion, since it was originally designed to be launched from the surface of the Earth, its thrust to weight ratio is by definition greater than 1. You are being pushed forward by atom bombs. This is not a gentle shove. This is, you know, like Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell said, this is God's knocking and he wants in bad. And so the glory of Orion is that the bigger you make the ship, the better it works. With most spacecraft, the bigger you make the ship, you know, it works about the same. If you're making a nuclear electric spacecraft twice as big, you have to have twice as many reactors, twice as many engines, you know, twice as much surface area for the radiators. With an Orion, the bigger you make it, the more efficient it works. So the small ones that were about 10 meters in diameter, designed to be launched from atop a Saturn V, those had a specific impulse of in excess of 3,000 seconds, which is 10 times greater than chemical engines and about what you can get out of an electric system. But you've got the specific impulse of an electric system, but a thrust to weight in greater than one. So you're getting where you're wanting to go quickly. And as the things scale up, they went to the 20 meter, which was over 4,000 seconds specific impulse. And they had looked at 30 meter and above in advanced systems. They were talking about a specific impulse, perhaps up to 12,000 seconds, which means you can take a whole lot a long way in a very short period of time. The problem is, in order to do that, you have to expend a whole lot of nuclear weapons to do it. And so politically, there you go. I mean, you tell Congress, okay, we're going to build these spaceships, and every time they go anywhere, we need 1,000 atom bombs. So, you know, for the next 10 years, we're going to have to build 500,000 nukes. I think Congress is just going to look at you and say no.
It's not very plausible, but it's also against the space treaties, given that you're not supposed to have nuclear bombs going off in space.
Right. That's why I think if Elon Musk wants to pull this off, he's going to have to be like a Liberian registered ship.
Well, you know, he's still, I
don't think they signed the space treaty.
No, but he's a U.S. citizen, so the reach of the law would still apply to him.
Well, you know, if I actually had a reasonable prospect of an Orion, and I had the universe able to open up before me, that I could get to Mars in a matter of just a couple months, I could reasonably suspect that I could put, you know, a 1,000-ton colony on one of the moons of Saturn inside of 6 months. I'm pretty sure that I'd take one look at my American citizenship and go, eh. Well, I'm not going to be on Earth anymore, so what do I care what my citizenship is at that point?
Well, the law also applies to any launch license that has American components in it.
Yeah.
So you're going to be stuck no matter what. But if you can get off quickly, I guess you can, and get a launch license from some country, I guess you can get to Mars maybe before the cops will catch up with you.
Well, that's the beauty of Orion. If you're the only one that has one, the cops are never going to catch up to you. What are they going to come after you with?
You got an email from listener Kelly Starks. Let me see if I can read it. He says, I love your site and your products. I'll be stuck in traffic in the show. So here are my questions as to nuclear propulsion issues. Has anyone figured out cost numbers for systems like these, both the cost to orbit with launchers or the cost per ton transporting ore around the system, i.e. could you economically return one with an Orion and some lander? I think he's talking about the Orion capsule, but I'm not sure. I know there was work done to do a pulse laser fusion propulsion system, but more recently there's been research into mini or not mini fusion bombs using ultra-high-speed chemical explosives rather than atomic bombs as the trigger, potentially doing sub-kiloton fusion bombs with very little fallout or radiation. Could you speculate on an Orion-like launch system or deep space freighter using impulse devices?
Yeah. Over the past, well, at least 30 years, from time to time, various people that seem to know what they're talking about have come up with preliminary designs for nuclear explosives that are fission-free, which means they don't use uranium or plutonium to get the fusion going. With the inertial confinement, you know, laser system, you get rid of of the fission products, or the need for fission, by having these massive banks of lasers. And your resulting nuclear explosion is tiny. It's you know, like I said, the size of a grain of sand. But other people, such as Winterberg and a few others, have come up with designs that might work for kiloton, even megaton scale hydrogen bombs that, as the email suggested, are powered by chemical explosives. And the theory seems to be sound. The math seems to work. And the one issue I would have with that is, if this works, why haven't we seen it? Because the thing that has always kept, you know, knuckleheads, you know, anywhere from North Korea to Iraq, Iran, whoever, from having their own nukes is getting the fissile material. I mean, the design of a nuclear weapon is not exactly black magic anymore. You know, ever since the 50s, pretty much anybody who's wanted to have a spy has known how to design a nuclear weapon. If you can get away from needing uranium and plutonium, and instead you just need a whole lot of high explosives, we should have seen, you know, nukes popping off all over the place as people put this to the test. And I haven't, you know, I haven't heard of such a thing. Now, I suspect it might be possible that, you know, the CIA has noticed that somebody did in fact set off such a nuke and they put a news blackout on it, but I'm not quite that conspiratorial. But that said, if somebody can figure out how to make a fission-free nuke that's in the kiloton range that isn't too big, you know, something size of a garbage can, maybe, that's half a kiloton in yield, it's powered entirely by chemical weapons with, or chemical explosives, probably with the assistance of superconducting magnets that do this, that, and the other thing all while it's going on, then while the legality of a Orion-based launch system is still debatable, because that's still an atomic explosive in the atmosphere, your complaints about this from a environmental standpoint go away. Your complaints about this from a cost standpoint go away, because the biggest cost with Orion was always the cost of plutonium. Is every bomb consumes, you know, 20 pounds of plutonium.
Uh-huh.
And so if you've got 1,000 bombs just to get to orbit, that's a whole lot of plutonium. You know, I mean, even Doc Brown would have trouble stealing that much. But if you have a fission-free nuke, all you need is the chemical explosives, which presumably, you know, your chemical industry can whip up, and deuterium, you know, either in liquid form or, you know, lithium deuteride, something like that, which is, you can buy through the mail. So even though that propellant, that nuclear propellant, might be more expensive on a per-pound basis than, you know, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, the fact that your performance would be through the roof compared to a chemical rocket would presumably make an Orion-based launch system just dirt cheap in comparison. You know, a secondary, unintentional but nevertheless important advantage would be that since this thing is designed to be kicked in the butt by 1,000 nuclear explosions on its way to orbit, it is by definition the sturdiest launch vehicle you've ever seen. Which means if falling out of the sky and landing in the ocean, it'll shrug that off, you know. You know, pop a couple of, you know, flotation things and bob on the surface, and somebody tows it back to shore and loads it up, launches it again. So theoretically, a nuclear bomb-powered launch system would be easily reusable. But it's the atom bombs themselves that are the trouble.
You have a caller on hold. Are you ready?
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John from Montana.
Okay, go ahead, Montana John.
Hey, I guess my question is, in the atmosphere, if you were to light off a nuke behind this vehicle, the shock wave from air being heated and compressed could push the vehicle forward. Now, do you have to depend on ablating that back end of the vehicle somehow if you're doing this in a vacuum?
No. That's actually something that you see pop up a lot in people talking about Orion-type vehicles, that the pusher plate, the thing that the shockwave hits, would have to be covered with, you know, thick plastic for ablative. In fact, what the General Atomic team found in late 50s, early 60s, that a simple steel plate, circular plate, 10, 20, 30 meters in diameter, couple inches thick, you know, designed properly with the right contours, would be able to withstand repeated nukes and would get to no more than 200 and some odd degrees Fahrenheit after a standard mission increment. Now, the reason why it's able to do it, you'd think that having an atom bomb going off right next to you would be, you know, opening the gates of hell and melting your ship. And in fact, that's not the case, because especially in space, where these ships would spend most of their time, all an atom bomb is a bright flash, and that's it. Now, the atom bombs for an Orion vehicle are a small atom bomb, about a half a kiloton, starting with the small vehicles, inside of a can, a cylindrical can. Surrounding the nuke itself is something that looks like a rocket engine, with the nuke inside the combustion chamber. Inside the nozzle of this thing, what's called a radiation case, is made out of depleted uranium. Filling the nozzle is what's called a channel filler, and that's beryllium oxide. When the bomb goes off, the neutrons and prompt X-rays are directed by the radiation case into the beryllium oxide inside the nozzle. The beryllium oxide absorbs this stuff in that first brief microsecond after the bomb goes off, and the beryllium oxide gets hot enough that numbers don't really matter anymore. And just on the other side of the beryllium oxide, at the exit plane of the rocket nozzle, is a more or less flat slab of something like tungsten. It could be iron, could be plastic, could be water, depending on your design. But tungsten is what they baseline, because tungsten's good and dense. The beryllium oxide, which has reached a begrillion degrees, transfers that heat more or less instantly to the tungsten. And since the tungsten is a flat plate, it behaves just like a flat plate of high explosive. If you have a sphere of high explosive, when it explodes, the explosion goes in every direction equally. If you have a flat plate, it forms two jets, one forward, one aft, perpendicular to the face of the plate. And that's what happens to the tungsten. The tungsten is turned into a jet of plasma, which is directed at the pusher plate of your Orion. So you've got this jet of plasma moving at several thousand kilometers a second, heading towards the back of the ship, and the plasma itself is insanely hot. Well, what happens is when it hits the pusher plate, it doesn't interact with the plate long enough to transfer heat through conduction. This jet bounces off the plate in something on the order of a microsecond and disperses. It doesn't run up to the plate and stick to it. It bounces off. So this super hot stuff hits this plate, transfers momentum, but does not transfer heat. And so what they found, in order to keep the plate survivable, with every ejection of one of these bombs, the barrel of the cannon that projects through the pusher plate would have little jets around the rim of the muzzle, which would spray out a puff of silicone oil. And this would be smashed against the face of the plate. And when the bomb goes off, any excess heat would be absorbed by the silicone oil, which would, that thin, thin, vanishingly thin layer of oil would evaporate and carry away any unnecessary heat.
So, in effect, your reaction mass would be that tungsten plate.
Correct. If you just use an atom bomb, if you throw out just the purest atom bomb you can come up with out the back of your ship, again, in space, all you're going to get is a bright flash off it, and you're going to have some unfortunate radiation and, you know, bits of the bomb hitting your ship at, you know, a recognizable fraction of the speed of light,
right,
but not really much momentum. So what you're doing by putting this plate of tungsten on one side of the bomb is you're taking some percentage of the bomb's total energy, about 3% of the bomb's total energy, and converting it directly into momentum in the form of a tungsten jet. So you have to have some mechanism to transfer the energy of the bomb from something useless, like X-rays, into something useful, like a, you know, swift kick in the pants. Now, like I said, it doesn't need to be tungsten. You get better performance if you had a plate of water ice, you know, nice high specific impulse. It would really jack up your specific impulse. But it becomes an engineering problem, because it's, regardless of what the material is, you need a certain amount of mass to absorb that energy and transfer momentum. And whereas a plate of tungsten is, say, 14 inches in diameter and an inch or two thick, for water, you know, which has about, what, 1/18th the density, you would have to be considerably larger in diameter and thicker. And that means you have to have a bigger cannon.
Okay, so for your 4,000-ton spacecraft, assuming you're launching it from the surface of the Earth and into orbit, how much mass are you throwing away with that system as opposed to just using air as the medium for at least part of the ride?
Actually, I could look up the exact numbers if you give me a moment. But now, what you would do if you're doing a ground launch is you would use different pulse units. You'd have basically scheduled pulse units. And so your early pulse units, when you're launching from sea level, would have relatively low yield and would have relatively little, if any, propellant. They would rely on, you know, a couple metric tons of air being converted into a couple metric tons of angry air moving at very high velocity in the direction of the ship. And as you go up, the pulse unit yield would go up, and the pulse unit propellant would go up as well.
Okay, so then you gradually transition, say, into your tungsten, if that's what
right.
You're using.
Let's see. Yes, the propellant velocity is about 1.1 times 10 to the 7th centimeters a second. And, let's see. 443 kilograms of propellant smacking into the back end of a 4,000-ton Orion. Now, this comes in the form of a pulse unit. It's 32 inches in diameter, and if you read the official documents, which I've got a whole bunch of through the Freedom of Information Act, and you try to find what the yield is, you can find where they say the yield is, and they've erased it away. They don't want you to know what the yield is, but they left the math.
So you can work it out.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, what phase of the program you're talking about. Things changed over the years, but it's on the order of 25 to 35 kilotons. In space. So you're talking about something not a whole lot more powerful than the real earliest bombs, you know, Fat Man and Little Boy.
Yeah, they were about a dozen or 15 kilotons.
Right. And the pulse units for the 10-meter design, the one designed for launch atop a Saturn V, those were half kiloton units. I mean, they were tiny as far as, as nukes go. And again, if you want to find the details on the specifics of the warheads, those are covered up, or those are redacted. But there's enough information that I'm reasonably sure they were using the W-54 warheads, or modified versions, that were used on the Davy Crockett and the small atomic demolition munitions, which would range anywhere from 25 tons to about 1 or 2 kilotons.
Now, the Davy Crockett was the recoilless rifle.
Right.
With the nuclear warhead, was it not?
Correct. It was designed at the same time by the same people for a warhead the same size and the same yield. And so I'm reasonably certain that at least initially the plan was to use modified Davy Crockett warhead. Now, I'm not saying that they were planning on taking Davy Crockett's out of the field and rejiggering them into pulse units. I'm saying that the same basic core warhead would be designed as the core of a pulse unit.
So when is this going to be revised, and when are we going to have it? Duh. Hello. I want a timeline for when we can quit talking history and we can talk reality for the present.
Well, there is one way that I am reasonably certain that we could get Orion. I'm talking seriously here, not, you know, alien invasions or some such. I'm thinking something big, scary, and perfectly natural threatens to fall out of the sky. 2004, end of 2004, I thought that as an aerospace engineer working for ATK at the time, I thought that nature had provided the best Christmas present ever in 2004 with the revelation of the asteroid 2004 MN4, now known as Apophis.
Yeah, it's not going to fall out of the sky, though.
Sadly, no. at the time, for a couple of days there, NASA kept revising their estimates. And every day, it was getting higher and higher possibility of it smacking into the Earth. Now, Apophis is, what, a couple hundred meters in diameter?
Yeah.
It's enough that it would trash a nation, screw up a continent, and, you know, destroy the world economy, wreck the weather for a year or two. But it's not enough that it would, you know, it's not an extinction level event. But the thing is, it's far enough out. You know, it would come by in 2028 and then again in 2036, I think. If in 2005 we had determined that, oh crap, it's a 1-to-1 probability that this thing is going to hit us in 2036, we would have 30 years in order to mount a defense. And realistically, the only mechanism we've got to divert an asteroid that size is nuclear weaponry. And I know there are a lot of people that have watched Hollywood's idea about diverting asteroids and comets and come away thinking, well, that's stupid. That's because Hollywood is, well, stupid. If you've got an asteroid incoming and you're sending out Bruce Willis to take care of it, the last thing you do is try to drill a hole into the thing and put a nuke inside it, try to blow it up. That's going to fail on many, many levels. It's just not a good idea. Not for the least is that even if you manage to crack it in half, you haven't diverted it any. But what Orion did is it showed back in the early 1960s that you can take a small nuke out in space, stand it off from something heavy, and through a little bit of engineering genius, use propellant, you know, channel filler and propellant to convert the bright, shiny flash of a nuke into a good, swift kick in the pants from a mechanical standpoint. And so I ran the numbers, 2013, I think it was, when the rock fell out of the sky over Chelyabinsk, Russia, blew up and blew out a whole lot of windows.
Windows and things, right.
Right. And I assumed the half-kiloton nuke from the 10-meter design, actually one kiloton from an Air Force variant of it. Overall diameter 14 inches, total weight of 189 pounds, and the tungsten propellant was 75.5 pounds. If we had actually used this against the Chelyabinsk asteroid, whatever, which was about 10,000 tons, it would have moved it, it would have imparted a delta V of about 20 centimeters per second, which is not a whole lot, but it's one of those things that if you do it a couple days, a couple weeks in advance, that's enough.
John, any comments from you?
Well, I guess my only comment on that would be you'd also have to know something about the strength of the rock or asteroid or whatever you're looking at to make sure that you don't break it up.
Well, here again is where something akin to an Orion pulse unit would be exactly what you might want to use, because the pulse unit jet comes out essentially in the form of a cone. Think of it kind of like a shotgun blast of plasma. What you'd want to do is you want to stand off the pulse unit some distance from the asteroid so that the diameter of the jet at that distance is roughly the diameter of your asteroid. So that
you're
hit
distributing
the entire hemisphere all at once. Whereas if you were to put a rocket on it, you know, if your asteroid is a rubble pile, just a collection of gravel loosely bound together by gravity, you know, the rocket might simply punch a hole through it. If you set off a nuke on it, you'll simply blow out bits and pieces of it. But if you stand off a nuke and hit it with a jet, you will shove the entire mass. Now, if it's truly a loosely bound collection of crap, you will scatter it. But then your next pulse will take the low mass stuff, the dust and grains of sand, and scatter that to the four winds right now. I mean, that stuff will be gone, and you'll be left with a cloud of gravel and boulders and whatnot. And you can deal with those almost on an individual basis. I mean, the smaller stuff you can simply ignore. It'll simply burn up in the atmosphere. The big stuff, you just keep nuking it over and over until it's gone. And the beauty of an Orion system is these are small units. We're talking a 200-pound thing that is powerful enough to move an asteroid. Well, if you were to go there, you take a bunch of them. You know?
Guys, we need to take a break. John, you want to hold on the line?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to take a break because we're coming up on the top of the hour. Everybody stay where you are, and back with Scott and caller John in 3 minutes.
Advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday Space Show program. And our guest today is Scott Lowther. We're talking about nuclear pulse explosions for lots of uses. Space. During the break, we were talking about possibly using forms of this for generating power. Of course, when this is all going to happen is the $64,000 question. And our phone line is clear. Caller John got off the phone during the break, and if you would like to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. And also a word from two of our sponsors. So one of them is Orbital ATK. It's a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial venture, and defense. And then Integrated Space Plan as our sponsor. They are that it is a highly developed flowchart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see technologies and destinations built upon one another, explore lots of individual elements in more detail. Go to their website, thespaceplan.com. It's all one word. And check them out. And you can also buy a copy of their Space Plan poster. It's available in one of two sizes. And we have another phone call, Scott. You ready for this?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Brian Lobsher calling from Olympia, Washington.
Hi, Brian. Good to talk to you again. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Go for it.
Well, I would like to ask, can you give us some kind of historical context to what these guys were thinking about? Because clearly, they turned their backs on kind of an incremental approach, you know, using nuclear thermal rockets and moving up. They really went for how can we use nuclear power to get the most massive thing into orbit? So can you tell us, like, what they were thinking?
Well, basically just that. Like I mentioned earlier, Ted Taylor, the guy who sort of initiated the project, he was a nuclear weapons designer. That was his joy in life at that time. And you don't really design nukes for small things. He was a fission guy, not a fusion guy. So he designed the largest fission bomb the United States ever set off, which was like 400 kilotons, which is just gigantic for a pure fission bomb. And he didn't think small. You know, he thought that the perfect response to Sputnik was to say, oh yeah, that's cute, look at this, and to launch meaningful spacecraft. Because his goal, you know, the one of the mottos of the people working on it was Saturn by 1970.
Wow.
And when they said Saturn, they didn't mean a Cassini probe. They were talking about, I think, something like 1,500 tons in destination payload. Spacecraft with hundreds of people. Basically a small town, the Starship Enterprise. Because if you want to explore Saturn, you know, sending three guys out there, you know, even if you can beam them out there instantly, sending three guys is not really going to do the job. You know, if you want to explore someplace, you've got to make an effort. You know, as awesome as Apollo was, it never really got a whole lot better than flags and footprints. You know, all that effort brought back a couple hundred, or maybe I think it was like 1,000 pounds of rocks, which is cool, but in Orion, you could bring back a mountain of lunar material, you know.
So short of a, you know, a asteroid threatening us, is there any kind of structure that needs to be launched intact in space that this could be used for?
Well, there are military applications that Orion was uniquely suitable for. But today, basically large-scale manned missions, that's about it.
So Musk wanting to take 10,000 people to Mars,
right,
is made to order for something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a science report just came out in the last couple days talking about how astronauts' eyesight keeps getting turned to garbage after a few months on board the space station.
Right, we've talked about that a lot on the show.
Okay. Well, if you're sending hundreds of people to Mars to spend the rest of their lives, I mean, you could you know, use a nuclear thermal or nuclear electric or even chemical if you really want to punish them and send them on a Hohmann transfer that takes 6-8 months to get there. And then by the time they get there, who knows what kind of condition they'll be in if they don't have you know, artificial gravity on board the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're sending them there in microgravity, they'll be worse off than the space station astronauts.
Uh-huh.
But in Orion, you get them there in weeks, you know, not months. And so it'd basically be an ocean cruise in theoretically microgravity. However, the sheer size of these vessels, you know, 30 meters in diameter, 100 feet in diameter, means you could easily spin the craft around the central axis and generate some measure of artificial gravity on the inside. Now, maybe it might be too small to spin it up fast enough, you know, without making people hurl, you know, to generate, you know, one full gravity or maybe even Mars gravity. But, you know, in all the years we've spent in space, we've never have actually done the tests of, you know, artificial gravities to find out, okay, you know, what makes people sick? What do we need, you know, to keep people healthy, you know, over a long term? But an Orion would be able to send a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of people, a whole lot of fast. And the sheer size of the vessel will keep them a lot safer than if you send them out in fragile little bubbles.
Well, remember, the best way to keep them healthy and safe is not to send them at all.
Well, yeah, sadly.
That's,
yeah,
so
that's
funny.
So keep that in mind for those of you that are risk averse.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem I had with the movie Apollo 13 is it helps to cement the failure is not an option meme. Because if failure is not an option, then that leads to only one thing, not trying.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you try, then failure is a possibility. And if it's unthinkable, well, then you don't want to try because you might fail. Whereas if you don't try, then you don't fail. And, not trying to get too political here, but that seems to be kind of where we are in a lot of things these days, is the best way to do it is to not do it.
But then keep in mind, you get an award and you get a medal for thinking about it. So it's all the same in the end.
Yeah.
You know, what can I say?
Yeah. Depending on your point of view, it comes down, I'm not sure how much it's politics or ideology, so much as worldview. Orion is either the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. Because it is, in a sense, manliness in a can. I mean, there is nothing wimpy about Orion. You're setting off atom bombs, damn it. You're not, you know, not gentle breezes slowly pushing you to Mars. You're riding on a column of atomic flame. You're getting every second, once a second for 1,000 seconds, you're getting kicked in the pants by 35 kilotons. Depending on your point of view, this is the most awesomest thing ever, or it's how horrible.
What would the G-force be as you're accelerating?
At worst, when the thing was at burnout, when the ship was at its lowest mass,
right?
Your peak acceleration would be about 4 Gs. However, the thing about Orion is that your acceleration is constantly swinging because your vessel is a three-element system. You've got a pusher plate, which is a vast sheet of steel, circular sheet of steel, weighs, you know, 800, 1,000 tons. I mean, it's just a massive chunk of mass. It is connected to what's called the intermediate platform by a series of pneumatic, bicycle tires, inner tubes, you know, circular pneumatic tubes, a whole bunch of them, connect the pusher plate to the intermediate platform. When the bomb goes off, the platform is accelerated forward at something like 50,000 Gs, which is, of course, non-survivable. But the pneumatic shock absorbers between the plate and the intermediate platform allow this thing to oscillate back and forth, and it shoves the intermediate platform forward with an average acceleration of hundreds of Gs. And the intermediate platform is now connected to your ship itself and the payload with pistons, pneumatic pistons, and they reduce the hundreds of Gs to a couple of Gs. It simply spreads it out over time. That initial 50,000 G burst, which lasts for a microsecond, is converted into an average of over 1G for 1 second. And so if you are on board the ship, as you're being boosted, you will feel yourself swinging. The description given at the time, once they actually ran the numbers, is you would feel like you were on a children's swing, swinging up and down and up and down. And, you know, with a peak acceleration of around 4 G's at the worst. So it would be weird. You would not want to be walking around on the flight deck while this was going on. But it's not even as bad as riding a space shuttle.
I'd love to be there when you testify to support this in Congress. I think this would be the priceless congressional testimony of all time.
I don't think that would work very well because I've got limited patience for idiocy. And the very first senator that comes back
well,
at me
to,
with...
You have to teach him. You have to educate him.
Yeah, and I'm not good at that. I'm more of the ranting at the morons thing.
Well, but that doesn't get you to your end goal, which would be to have Orion rejuvenated in you.
Yeah, why I'm not a politician.
You're a Los Alamos guy, Brian, and a physicist.
Yeah.
What do you think of all this?
I'm a former Los Alamos guy. Well, of course, this is not new to me.
No, I know this.
I really think that this is yet another example of how, after World War II, scientists and engineers who had like gone through the war and all that, they were fearless.
Yeah,
I mean, they weren't worried about looking at anything that was possible, and figuring out how it could work. And I just think it's something we need to remember. This approach that, you know, what can we do with this? Oh, that sounds far out. No, that's not what I asked. I asked, can it be done?
Yeah,
it can. Okay, fine. I mean, I applied this same thing to, you know, the space elevator, right? I mean, it sounds crazy. It turns out it is crazy in terms of material requirements, but other than that, it's not crazy. So, yeah. So I think that we need to remember that we're capable of these kind of things. And if we want to take an incremental approach, you know, like a nuclear thermal rocket and then go from there, that would be something we could do right now. But, you know, to have something in our back pocket, you know, we got to launch, just like you said, an interceptor. It's got to be massive. It's got to get there quick. We want to disrupt this thing far out in space, you know, because hitting the rubble pile, it turns out, I know everyone, especially astronomers, say, oh, it's a terrible thing to do. It's only a terrible thing to do if you're at the terminal point where it's right near the Earth.
Right. It's in your backyard.
Right.
Yeah, if you do it far out, you impart a delta V perpendicular to the direction toward Earth. And those things will eventually drift out of the parameters of space in which they'll strike the Earth.
So, right.
So they'll be zero. They won't be in the impact parameter anymore. So it is a smart thing to do. And so you want to hit it as early and as far out as you can. And you want to hit it as hard as you can. So, you know, that is not a bad idea. And if, you know, the whole problem with the, you know, asteroid impact or comet impact is that, you know, the probabilities are so small, but the ramifications are huge. It could be the end of the human race. So, you know, how lucky do you feel this generation? Because if it happens on your watch, if you let the human race die on your watch, then you really screwed up.
So, yeah, well, yeah, but since nobody will be around to write the history, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
I know, but the alien archaeologists will say, oh, these poor bastards,
hey,
couldn't figure it out.
Brian, when you were at the lab, was it a fearless culture, or had that already changed?
No. I was one of the most fearless guys I knew, and I wasn't like these guys. Yeah, it's very – my experience in the division I was in, that really is my experience. They were very, very cautious. They had – bread and butter programs that they were kind of milking, you know. One of my colleagues was able to do a study that showed that part of what they were doing, and that was one of their big programs, was actually not required by the Defense Department. And they tried to squelch that report so they could keep their stuff going. So, no, unfortunately, the people who, you know, built the bomb and stuff like that, there's very, very few of those people with that mindset there. I would propose things and they would look at me like I was crazy, you know, and I would propose things and they would say, that's too risky. Now, we are a national laboratory. You know, this back when I worked for them, we were a national laboratory. We didn't have to turn a profit. And therefore, I thought we were supposed to be the ones who would think and try things that weren't going to make you money and might fail and do all the other kind of stuff. But most of the management was very averse to risk. One guy even kind of intimated to me that, hey, I don't want any trouble. You know, I got 3 years till retirement. I don't want any trouble. And I was very disappointed. It's one of the big reasons I left eventually. So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Risk aversion is a damn fine way to make sure that bad things will happen. You know?
Yeah, in the long run, I think you're right.
Because, yeah, being averse to risk means that, you know, that project you're working on might not blow up in your face, but it also means that nothing else will ever work. You know, imagine if the pharmaceutical industry was as risk averse as it is. if you were dying of some horrible cancer and there was some company that said that, well, we've got this thing that in preliminary trials with the mice seems to work, you know, however, due to rules and regulations and risk averseness, it'll be another 15 years before human trials and another 20 before, you know, it actually hits the market. If you're actually dying of cancer,
you die. You go ahead and die.
Yeah. Or you sneak into the place, do the Mission Impossible thing and sneak in and steal some of their stuff, and you shoot yourself up with it, and you either, you know, get cured of cancer or get turned into the Incredible Hulk. I mean, you never know. But if you're already at a 100%, you're going to die horribly, then risk is not that risky. And the thing is, we're living on a planet that eventually, now it might be 100 years, might be 5 billion years, but eventually something horrible is going to happen. And if we're not off the planet when it happens, then that's it, game over.
Or we're not protecting the planet when it happens. Right?
So guys, I have listeners, and I also have students in my graduate class that say we need to go settle Mars and eventually terraform it to preserve humanity because it's going to die on Earth. And then I have others that say we need to put the time and the R&D and the investment into protecting Earth rather than figuring out we have to go live on Mars. So with what you're talking about, Scott, you would be able to protect the Earth, and it wouldn't be that relevant to go live on Mars for the idea of saving humanity. There might be other reasons for doing it. Am I correct in applying your thing to that dilemma I get all the time?
Well, if you've got, let's assume that somebody actually comes up with the fission-free nukes, you know, so we don't have to expend, you know, 20 kilos of or 20 pounds of plutonium every time we set off a bomb, so we can in fact fire these things off as often as we want. So long as we keep a handle on that, so we don't have every chucklehead with an ideology getting hold of a chemical nuke. We can not only explore the solar system and colonize the system, we can commercialize the solar system. We don't have to say, okay, we're living on Earth and now we're also living on Mars. We can say we're living on every single asteroid that's got a drop of water on. We got people on comets. We got habitats every damn where, and these habitats can be moved from place to place using these, you know, Orion engines. And if you've got a 100 billion ton Orion or O'Neill colony that you've built in lunar orbit, and you want it to be in orbit, you know, in free orbit, you know, further out from the sun, and you can't use solar sails and electric engines and whatnot, and very, 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 very slowly move it out there, or you could put an Orion on it. And even a high-thrust Orion is still tiny compared to, you know, the mass of a colony.
Right.
But it's enough to actually shove it around in a reasonable time frame. So what you've done is turned this from a safety of mankind thing into safety of mankind is now irrelevant. Because think of it this way. Right now, every human you know is either on Earth or within a couple hundred miles of it. If something happens to Earth, every human you know is going to be real upset about it, briefly. But if something unfortunate happened in Tanzania, killed every single human in Tanzania, but not outside Tanzania, I assume, you know, management error amongst the deities or something, every human in Tanzania dies. That's going to be big news on CNN for a couple of days, then we're all going to, you know, get on with our lives. It won't matter. But at one point, every human you knew was in Tanzania, or at least every pre-human you knew was in Tanzania. That's where we came from. But now, if Tanzania dies, who cares? Granted, the Tanzanians would. You know, their family members, you know, whatnot, you know, people that are worried about such things. But the point is that if humanity scatters from Earth, at some point, the population of humans off Earth will exceed the population of humans on Earth. And at some further point, the population of humans on Earth will be trivial compared to the population of humans off Earth. So that if management error amongst the deities occurs and Earth simply blinks out of existence, or, you know, like in 2012, the sun suddenly starts spitting out mutated neutrinos or some damn thing, and the Earth melts. You know, everybody else in the universe will read about it in the newspaper on, you know, page B47, you know, on column 3, you know, Earth is gone. You go, eh, well, that's kind of a shame. And then they'll get on with their lives. So it's at some point, you transition from, oh, my God, we've got to save mankind, to we've done it. We don't need to worry about it anymore.
I also think it's incumbent upon us to do what we can do in this generation. You know, you'd say, Brian, your job is to, you know, make Star Trek a reality. I wouldn't bet on that. But as you know, I did go off and work on high-strength materials to help further the space elevator, and I'm having success with that. So I think we all have to, you know, at this point, I don't think we're going to make humans a star-faring race going between stars in my lifetime. But I think we can start on the road to spreading out through our solar system, and by the time we're done with that, people will have been thinking about actually going to the stars with people on board. I'm sure we will send probes. Maybe even in my lifetime, we might send probes to other stars, but...
Yeah, now there's something I hear commonly amongst fans of Orion that must be corrected. A lot of people overestimate Orion's capabilities. Carl Sagan in Cosmos talked about Orion as a way to build a starship. And Orion, as currently conceived, would just not work as a starship. Even 12,000 seconds, specific impulse, for the advanced Orion is still terrible for a starship. You won't get anywhere near 1% the speed of light with it. I mean, it's pathetic, you know, from a starship standpoint. So you're not going to go to the stars with Orion. But once you're out there, you know, once you've got a space-based infrastructure based on nuclear pulse propulsion, the people whose lives depend on it, you can bet they're going to work on, well, how can I make this better? And there are alternative nuclear pulse schemes that people have come up with, you know, the British Interplanetary Society with Daedalus and John Dale Solomon with Medusa, that result in very different vehicles from Orion, but still work off nuclear pulse, and you get the beginnings of true starships with them. Because everybody knows that if you want to go to the stars using known physics, it's either fusion or antimatter. And with nuclear pulse systems, you can get that hybrid between the two. Now, one way to set off a pellet is to bombard it with antiprotons rather than laser beams. and then direct the resulting effluence out the back with powerful magnetic fields. And you start talking about specific impulses of 100,000 seconds, 400,000 seconds, even pushing a million seconds. And this can move you to the nearer stars in a human lifetime. And if by that point you've got O'Neill habitats wandering around the solar system being shoved around by early generation Orions, then you could load one of these things up with people who are in it for the long haul, you know, and say, okay, it's 500 years to Alpha Centauri, but yeah, you'll get people that'll go.
Brian, I've got other people that want to use the phone. Are you through, or do you have more?
No, I think I said everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your call,
bye-bye.
Brian. So, listeners, the line is open, and if you want to call 1-866-687-7223. So I really would love to move from talking about this, like we're writing term papers in school, to implementing it.
Yeah, me too.
Well, so nobody has an implementation strategy. So what happens is it's just an academic wet dream.
At this point, yes.
Which is really frustrating.
Now, what I've been trying to do, and other people like George Dyson and others, is try to record the information. Because, you know, the original Orioneers, you know, the people that worked on the program late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, they're mostly gone. I was talking to an artist who worked on the program and was getting some good information out of him, and all of a sudden, I didn't hear from him anymore. You can kind of guess why.
He moved on.
Yeah.
You got another caller. Are you ready for this?
Sure.
Maybe this one will tell you how to implement it. What do you think? Welcome to the show, caller. Go for it.
Hi, this is Doug from Southern California.
Are you going to tell him how to implement it, or is this going to be more academic theory?
It's I think, a different thing. So my question is, I mean, we already have, we already know how to get propulsion with a higher ISP, which is ion propulsion. And so if we were to have, like, solar electric propulsion for cargo beyond LEO, so pushing cargo up to, for example, an EML staging point, or like a highly elliptical Earth orbit, as well as pushing cargo slowly, but pushing it to low lunar orbit and low Mars orbit. And then for people, you can't push them with ion propulsion slowly, like to the Van Allen radiation belt. But you could send them in a capsule, to the EML staging point. It seems like if you combine those two together, all you need is a relatively small chemical push from the staging point on towards Trans-Mars injection, including you could send large quantities of shielding up to those points. So it seems to me as though this technology doesn't face the challenge of having to get over the fears of developing nuclear propulsion. So my question is don't we have a an adequate alternative in the form of solar electric propulsion for cargo?
For cargo, yeah, I'd say using electric propulsion, solar, nuclear, whatever for cargo, fine. You know, if it takes 3 years, for a box lunch to get from Earth to Mars, that's great. Shoot them off one a month from now until infinity. And if you're on Mars, you wait 3 years and the first one shows up and the next one, then the next one, the next one. That's fine. But if you're trying to send people anywhere, or if you need to send something somewhere in a hurry, such as, incoming comet or asteroid, electric propulsion is just not going to cut it. Because while it takes a couple months for an electric system to spiral out of Earth orbit into a solar orbit, you're still only in solar orbit that's roughly equivalent to Earth. You still have to keep plugging away to get to Mars, and you are many months from Mars. Even if you ride a capsule and hop on board this thing as it's breaking away from Earth on its final spiral out, you're still a long way from Mars using electric propulsion.
So I think I addressed that, and I said that you can go ahead and send crew in a capsule chemically up
right.
to like staging point. So you don't spiral out, you know, you don't spiral people from low Earth orbit. You send them chemically, but it's a small amount. It's a capsule. You know, it's maybe less than 10,000 kilograms that you send chemically the crew in their capsule to the ML staging point where they dock with the craft, the space orbital propellant, and the cargo that has been sent previously by solar vector propulsion. Then when they dock with all their stuff at the EML staging point, then it's a relatively small chemical push, and now they're on Trans-Mars injection with all of their stuff.
Yeah, but even using a chemical rockets, you're still pretty much restricted to a minimum energy trajectory, you know, Hohmann transfer. You're a long way from Mars, you know, doing
so
it that way.
What's the problem with taking 6 to 8.5 months? I mean,
with cargo, no problem at all. Like I said, it doesn't matter. You know, for most cargoes, it doesn't. You're sending a bulldozer to Mars, doesn't really matter how long it takes to get there. You're sending people there, like we were talking about earlier. 6 months on board the space station turns a human body into garbage. You know,
yeah,
and so now these people have turned to mush. And they're not even been protected by the Van Allen belts and the mass of Earth beneath them, so they have been bombarded with radiation for those 6 months, 6-8 months. Then they get to Mars and there's nobody there to help them out of the capsule once they land. You know.
Well, I would throw artificial gravity in, and that would address most of the physical capability problems of the crew. Because,
sure.
The microgravity, which causes most of the health problems.
Right. But like was mentioned before, what gravity level do you use? I mean, the higher gravity level, the more massive the ship is. You know, the more massive the centrifuge is. And
I wish you could use that say tether and spin up.
Once more?
Tether and spin up to 1G.
Well, if you know, we know humans do well at 1G in the long term because, you know, that's how we live our lives. We don't know how humans do at Mars gravity for months at a time. You know, we don't know how they do at lunar gravity. You know, it may well be that all the physical effects that astronauts have been subjected to goes away if you simply have a 1/20th G acceleration. We simply don't know. And that's something that, sadly, we could have had a space station to test that decades ago, but we haven't.
Right.
But if it turns out that you really need, you know, something like lunar or Mars gravity in order to maintain, you know, keep your bones from turning to mush and your eyeballs from turning into fried eggs, that's going to weigh a hell of a lot more than an artificial gravity system rated for 1/20th of a G. So if your propulsion system is as low ISP as a chemical propulsion system has to shove all that mass to Mars, that's a whole lot of dead weight going real slow.
Well, it's weight that could be shared. In other words, your water-bearing provision could be double duty. You know, anything you have on board is going to shield against radiation.
Yeah.
And again, it's a relatively small chemical push to push everything on Trans-Mars injection if you're, for example, up at highly elliptical Earth orbit, because you're almost at CMI. It would take less than 1 kilometer per second, delta V, to push you.
Again, you're only going to be pushing it onto a minimum energy transfer orbit. So
yeah,
you're taking months and months to get there. And past everything else, you know, past, you know, health concerns and mass and all that, you know, if you've got a spacecraft that takes 6 months to get there and you got a spacecraft that takes 1 month to get there, if you're sending people 6 months, that's 5 wasted months, 5 months of productivity where these people aren't productive. And so if you're sending whole colonies of people, you know, they could be doing stuff on Mars. They could be, you know, building buildings, raising farms, having babies, all things that you can't or don't want to do on the spaceship.
So if you're looking at the far distant future, I think I might agree with you. I'm saying in the near term, it's not clear to me that we need anything above, you know, beyond the solar electric propulsion and, you know, the small chemical pushes.
Well, it I guess it kind of depends on exactly what you want to do. I mean, if you're sending, you know, purely scientific expeditions or if you're sending colonies. You know, if you're sending colonies, you got to do it right.
So it depends on what you mean by colonies. If you're sending colonists, that can start with relatively few people to start the colony. And I advocate sending a few people initially and having them stay on Mars with an Earth return option. But the goal is for them to stay on Mars because if you can have people stay on Mars as long to the point where they don't, where you eliminate a crew rotation, you could save quite a bit of money. So I think there's real strong advantages, both cost advantages as well as risk advantages, to not going through the process of bringing them back and launching the replacement. So I think we ought to send a few people initially, and they ought to go with the intent of trying to stay for as long as possible. So I call that the beginnings of colonization. But, yeah, I would agree that when it gets to, you know, sending tens of thousands of people each year, then yeah, I think the travel time becomes, you know, a significant issue then.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for answering my question.
Thank you for calling, Doug. Appreciate hearing from you. Bye bye. We're coming up on close to a 2-hour show, so give us a summary. And what can we do? I mean, again, I'm focused on action. You know, it's like that Norditrack commercial, incline. So we're talking about action, implement. I've heard this for 15 years. I mean, not your specific idea, because I've been doing the space show for 15 years, and nuclear propulsion has been a subject since almost day one. And, you know, I've had people on from the Idaho Lab and Marshall Space Flight Center and graduates that are starting entrepreneurial companies to go out and start commercial nuclear propulsion companies using tungsten as a fuel. And Jim Dewar, who's great on history, and he wants to launch nuclear rockets from Earth and change the paradigm. And you, and nothing, there's not even a hint of a policy that could implement anything. Zilch, zero. Tons of interest and love in the space community, but it's a goose egg.
Well,
it's frustrating.
As far as policy goes, I can't really help you there. what needs to happen, and not just for Orion, Nuclear Pulse, whatever, but what needs to happen generally is a massive sociological change.
Boy, you can say that again.
Because all through the 1960s, the atom is our friend. And then starting in the 70s, the anti-nuclear movements, which were to some degree larger or lesser supported by the Soviets, started to trash nuclear energy in general. Because if you make people scared, make Westerners scared of nuclear reactors, then they're sure as hell going to be scared of nuclear bombs. Well, what we need to do is find a way to reverse that. Get people not scared of nukes. You know, because right now, if we needed to go, if we saw, oh crap, in 5 years, you know, here it comes, we're all going to die unless we get an Orion out there, I'm not sure we have the talent to pull it off anymore. Because we simply don't have the nuclear industry that we once had. I'm not saying that the people working in the industry aren't great. I'm saying that if we'd had the nuclear industry we should have had, we'd had a lot more people.
Scott, I want to tell you something, and the listeners to you, listeners who are addicted to the space show and have heard a lot of programs have heard me say this before. In 1964, a friend of mine and I, we were in high school or just graduating, and we were in Tulsa. We got ourselves on an American Airlines Electra turbojet. That was, you know, really state of the art from Tulsa. And we went to the New York World's Fair, 1964. And we're at the New York World's Fair. We went there for a couple of days. And GE had a thing, and Westinghouse had a thing, and there were a couple of others, and it was all about how our future was the atom, and you'd go into the houses of tomorrow, and the presence of the atom, and they build it as the atom, you know, was there friendly. I mean, this was going to harness the universe for us in our domestic life in every way whatsoever. And we were, you know, it was easy to accept it because we could see what it was doing, right?
Yeah.
And something changed after that period. After, maybe it was the 70s, maybe it was the Vietnam War that changed it. Maybe it was the corruption in government with Watergate that changed it. The protest of the Vietnam War. I don't know. The culture changed, and things, we became hysterical about things, and we became fearful about who we were and what our powers were and what we could do. And instead of the atom being our friend, nuclear was our enemy. It was going to destroy the world.
Yeah.
And it's been that way with politicians for the most part. The politicians have become leaders. Not all politicians rise to the level of becoming a leader and hold enough of an office where they can actually do something. Most congressmen are ineffectual. We know that. But, you know, if you rise to being able to really impact and influence policy, it's been downhill ever since. And the kinds of technologies that get pushed and go forward, it's really a different world than what it was when I was growing up, and we had the world at our feet, and we could do anything, and the atom was our friend to help us do this.
Well, I would hazard a guess that going after politicians is the wrong approach, because politicians are, let's face it, most of them don't give a damn one way or the other.
Well, they're the mirror image of us. We elect
ourselves.
If you
want to change the future, you've got to change society. And, who influences society? And
Well, teachers. Teachers do. And authors, you know, that write books.
And entertainers.
Journalists.
Like,
TV show. You're right, entertainer. But how do you influence, you know, a closed-minded, you know, group of people for the most part?
If you could somehow get Kim Kardashian on board with nuclear power, I think we could be on Mars by next year.
Well, you get her on the space show and we'll work on her. you can co-host the program. I'd have no problem wanting people to co-host that program, let me tell you.
I think you'd probably want to have a webcam.
I was going to say that would be a space show webinar. I'd even go on a diet for that one.
Yeah.
I'd thin down for that one. But, yeah, maybe her or some of these guys that do the late night stuff, you know, the comedy stuff, you know, that seemed to, you know, like Jon Stewart certainly influenced any number, you know, millions of people with his comedy show.
Well, take a look at history. The Three Mile Island disaster was not, I mean, When you go through the records, try to find how many people were injured by Three Mile Island. Officially, none. How much radiation was released at Three Mile Island? Officially, none.
Yeah.
You know, it was contained. It wasn't a disaster. In a normal, sane world, that would have been 5 minutes on the evening news that night, and then life would have gone on. Unfortunately, I think it was 2 weeks before Three Mile Island, the China Syndrome opened. You know, the movie about a nuclear reactor that melted down.
With Jane Baby.
Right.
She'd gotten off the anti-aircraft gun and was now in the nuclear reactor business.
One single movie, ill-placed in time, has perhaps done more to damage the nuclear industry than anything else. So it's the effect that a single entertainment product can have. So if we could come up with the inverse of the China Syndrome, that might do it. The problem is that entertainment, you know, drama, comes from conflict, bad, horrible things happening. And, you know, how do you have a movie about how great nuclear power is and have it yet be entertaining? Sadly, I'm
well, I mean, they use nuclear power to save, you know, the world from, you know, those two dreadful asteroid movies.
Well, even then, though, they didn't really. It was Bruce Willis that saved the world, not nuclear power, you know. It didn't have anybody explain what a nuclear bomb was, you know, or how it works. And even then, that's not really what you want. What you want is a movie where the world is saved by a nuclear power plant somehow or other. I don't know how you would do that. And somebody in the movie shuts down a protester. You know, somebody, you know, you got the Jane Fonda type in there in the movie who's, you know, nuclear power bad, blah, blah, blah. And you've got, you know, say Brad Pitt or somebody that people pay attention to explain in honest but yet comprehensible terms why nukes are great, and then in the end of the movie, nukes save the day.
Well,
that maybe might do it. But I personally, though, you know, with, you know, The Walking Dead and all this other stuff, I think people just like things that happen bad. You know, just like the movie Tomorrowland pointed out, people just eat up horrible things.
Well, we're not going to end the show that way, so we're going to keep it going. So,
okay.
So give us Scott's implementation action plan to revise our culture.
Oh, well, A, I'd have to win the mega lotto thing and wind up with about $500 million. Then I'd start funding movies.
Seriously, you'd go after this by writing scripts and funding movies and TV scripts to change the zeitgeist of the country.
Right, that's how it changed in the first place.
Okay.
You know, if you can't hammer people over the head and get them to change their minds, you got to convince them, or you just got to trick them. And Hollywood is real good at tricking people, you know. And you will believe a man can fly, and you'll also believe that a robot can turn into a car. And you will believe that Jane Fonda knows what the hell she's talking about with regard to nuclear power.
And you can be mutated and turn into a monster.
Right. You know, and, you know, Godzilla was awakened by atomic blast and is now a radioactive monster that shoots death beams out of its mouth. I mean, this is, you know, straight out of fairy tales, but, you know, it used to be fairy tales was, you know, stuff that didn't really, you know, you couldn't build national policy around fairy tales.
But it sold. It made, you know, Godzilla movies have made hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, you know, people love monsters. People love horrible things happening. You know, a movie about a zombie plague or just some sort of epidemic that wipes out, you know, 90% of everybody. And this is, you know, remember a few years ago there was a movie, Contagion, came out, which was a movie about basically a modernized version of the Spanish flu.
Right.
Well, that movie didn't make anywhere near the kind of money that World War Z made, because partially because it was realistic, which meant kind of boring, and partially because at the end, they saved the day. Yeah, a whole bunch of people died, but it wasn't, you know, a global apocalypse. Whereas a zombie outbreak that doesn't get out of the one building is not going to be a terribly interesting movie. People want to see the zombies get out. You know, and eat all of Chicago.
Okay, so step one for Scott's plan is to be able to fund a different kind of movie and TV programming.
Right.
And step two? What do you do after you do? I mean, it's going to take decades if you're going to try to change the culture through movies and TV.
Well, you start with changing the culture. And if you've got decades, then you watch. And if culture starts to change, becomes pro-nuclear again, then you start just slipping in more nuclear power plants. You know, people want green energy, and really, if you want high energy density green energy, you can't really do much better than nuclear power.
Yeah, and if you paint them green instead of gray, you got green energy. What the hell?
Yeah. You know, if we can go to the thorium reactors, which there's no reason why we can't other than politics.
Right.
Those are cleaner at every level than a uranium.
And they can't be used for weapons.
Right, which should make, you know, the anti-nuclear people happy. But you're still stuck with, oh, thorium is, you know, nuclear, nukes bad. So you got to start there. And if your initial start is sufficiently successful that people begin to accept nukes, and you start replacing the old reactors, because the sooner we replace the old reactors with new ones, the better. Because, you know, the older a reactor is, the more likely something horrible is going to happen. You know, and if something horrible does happen, if we have an American Fukushima, then that's it. Game over. You know, pack up, go home. We're done. You know, nukes are over. We're a one planet species from now until the time we go extinct.
Well, unless M-Drive or something like that comes about.
I've got no particular faith in that.
Or Alcubierre's.
Even that requires just a whole lot of power that would be best provided with a nuclear reactor.
So the people I know in the film industry that are space cadets and space people, and I do know a lot of them, they like to focus on space documentaries about how inspiring it is for this kid to have his dream and go to space, or you know, to make you know, how cool it would be to do the overview effect. That's another one. They made a TV series out of the overview effect, on and on and on like that. But they don't think about doing what you've just suggested, which is to go make a conventional movie about a more or less conventional topic, except do the inverse of the China syndrome, but make it where the nuclear is the good guy, and the Jane Fondas get destroyed.
Right.
That's not a space film to them, because they think the space film is that you got to show the moon, or you show Mars, or you show the rocket blasting off, and everybody's inspired, and the JPL people are all clapping and jumping up and down when Curiosity landed. You know, all of that. You can see endless stuff from film school students and film people about that, and you can for the last, I don't know, however many years you want to go back. But you don't see anything like what you're talking about, which I think is actually a very, very good idea. And I think it's a really slow approach, but I think it's a good approach.
Well, the thing is, you don't need to do just one thing. You know, I would be all in favor of having somebody who's a bit more politic than me, or perhaps far, far more politic than me, out there flacking for Mars colonization right now with nuclear rockets of some type or another. That'd be great. And at the same time, having people work to change society slowly from within. You know, with, there have been a bunch of space movies recently, and I've liked a bunch of them, but almost all of them make space look like a death sentence. You know, Gravity. You know, it was a beautiful movie. Holy crap, that was a beautiful movie. You know, Sandra Bullock out there floating around in space and whatnot. But it's everything is death. And then The Martian is an astonishingly good movie, an astonishingly good book. And in the end, it turned out to be way better than most. But it's still Mars is trying to kill him. Interstellar. When the first trailer for Interstellar hit a year before the movie opened, It was with Matthew McConaughey reading a monologue about this is what humans do. We push the envelope. We explore. And I was looking forward to the most inspiring space movie ever. And it turned out to be nothing but 2 hours of Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway crying in spacesuits.
Anne Hathaway was fine. I don't have any. You got to put this in perspective, Scott.
Well, imagine.
Well,
if
you have a new one coming out that Doug called to my attention a couple of weeks ago. It's coming out next month. Well, I don't remember the name of it, but it's about Gravity Boy, who.
The kid born on Mars.
Yeah, because the woman astronaut going to Mars doesn't know she's pregnant.
Yeah.
Or she hides it and lies about it. One of the two, and then the kid grows up on Mars and wants to come back to Earth.
Yeah.
So I call it Gravity Boy, but that's not the name of the movie.
Yeah. Well, think about the movie Interstellar. The basic idea of Interstellar is that Earth is turning to garbage. We need to go someplace else in order to survive. Okay, that's fine. That's good.
That was a horrible movie. I really disliked it.
Yeah. But imagine if instead of that, okay, they found this wormhole out there that takes them to someplace else in space.
Right.
But instead of, oh my God, we're all going to die unless we find someplace else, imagine if it was, everything is fine, but we found this wormhole, and won't it be awesome to go out there, explore, have adventures, and get richer than God? You know, instead of, oh crap, everything is horrible, this is our only hope to not be completely horrible, imagine if it was, this is our chance for utter awesomeness.
Well, I don't think the culture would have liked going out there to get riches and all of that. I think that would have probably been a non-starter.
Well, that's one of the things you got to change.
Well, that's what you're talking about. I understand
that. And these things take time. It you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and Greenpeace didn't conquer the world in a day.
Except the guy who started Greenpeace supports nuclear power plants.
Yeah, and they ignore him.
Of course they'll ignore him, because he did a really good job founding Greenpeace.
Yeah.
And you don't need a really good education to be part of these organizations.
if depending on how you define really good, I mean, if you've got a master's degree in 17th century, you know,
literature,
French poetry, then great, you know.
Well,
that's a good education that will teach you how to actually make the world a better place. But if your education is in civil engineering or, God forbid, nuclear engineering, then your education's worthless.
Well, I guess we're going to have to end the show at 2 hours, Scott, but I was really hoping for the blueprint for the future other than making movies.
Well,
you got to do better than that before you can consider this a rehearsal for your upcoming to-be primetime presentation on this subject. You got to have something better than make movies.
Well,
because it's great to spend an hour and 58 minutes laying out your case and giving out the advantages and talking about the technology and the safety and the this and the that and the other. And then you come to the end and poof, there is no end. You can't move forward because there's no path forward.
Well,
now think about how the balloon has had the air let out of it. I mean, so you gotta, this is your rehearsal show. You gotta come up with a pathway forward. You just can't leave it with the academic, this is why, this is the expertise behind it, this is this, or some version of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be exactly what you're talking about. But you got to move it onto a path. And I don't know how to do it, but then you're the guest.
Okay, I do have an approach for you then.
Okay.
So again, it starts off with me winning the lotto. And I take $500 million and devote it specifically to developing an immortality serum. That not only keeps you immortal, proof from all diseases and cancer, but keeps you young and healthy and happy.
We're never going to get there.
Well, let's just say somebody does a good job of convincing the world he's done it. Okay?
Okay.
And demonstrates it to the world in a convincing way so that a good fraction of the world's population believes, holy crap, I could live young forever. And then he says, I've taken the one set of blueprints for this particular gene code or nanite or drug or whatever it is. And remember that mission to Pluto I launched last month? It's on that. If you want it, you got to go get it. And the only way you're going to catch that tiny little ship that I sent out past Pluto on an extremely high-energy trajectory is you're going to have to develop an extremely powerful, very advanced spacecraft to go chase it down.
Well, but that's not going to happen. Let me run this by you. Let's say there is some crazy rich guy. I mean, really crazy, like the guy in the movie Contact.
Yeah.
And he understands what you're talking about. Let's just use your model for this. And he says, you know, to hell with regulations, to hell with the law. I'm going to do this on my own, and I'm going to build this on my own, and I'm going to go stick it in the face of the world, and then they can either spin on it or they can take it for free and develop it.
Yeah.
And he actually figures out how to build the propulsion unit, and somehow he manages to pull it off and launch it from some place, regardless of world regulations or anything else, and it can be tracked, and he demonstrates the technology going to Mars or someplace and says, hey, world, it's yours. I showed you how to do it. Now, what are you going to do with it? And this guy's some crazy guy like the guy in Contact who's dying up there, you know, that could build the machine, the redundant machine. Somebody might be able to defy global regulations and find some place to do this and has the money and the capability to do this and just do it as a demonstration gift to the world.
Yeah.
I think it's implausible. I think it's highly unlikely, but I don't think it is impossible that somebody might be able to muster the resources and the technology to do this.
Well, if you're worth $10 billion, and there are a surprising number of people that are worth more than $10 billion,
right?
You've got more than enough money to hire the people and the technology you need to actually put those fission-free nuke ideas to the test.
Well, that or, you know, if you weren't going to do it fission-free, you'd have to find a way to get the plutonium, which might be pretty hard.
Yeah.
But see,
that's the problem with a standard nuke, is that plutonium is just damn hard to come by.
Well, yeah, unless you could care less about how you get it.
Yeah.
And your purpose for getting it is benign, so that you're not a crackpot that's going to go give it to somebody to blow you up.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe someday somebody will evolve to the point of saying, you know, enough is enough of all this crap. I'm just going to go do it and give it to the world as a technology demonstrator, and then the world can either crap on it or use it.
Yeah. Well, if you got your contacts, S.R. Haddon takes his money and builds himself a ground-launched Orion and launches himself and 100 of his best friends to Mars and simply plants the S.R. Haddon flag on Mars and says, I claim this. This is mine.
Which wouldn't hold up, but that's besides the point.
Well, possession being 9/10 of the law, if you want to actually contest his holding that plot of land on Mars, you got to go there yourself.
Yeah, but even if it was contested with the Outer Space Treaty and all of that, the flag would be there.
Yeah,
you know, and he would have done it, and nobody else can get there and do it. So maybe they'd accept that technology and refine it and develop it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the space. When did the space program make its biggest strides? Is when we were in competition with somebody, you know. You might not even need to actually develop Orion. You simply convince the CIA that the Chinese are doing it.
And we'll do. I don't. You one would hope they'd have better intelligence than that.
Yeah, you'd hope a lot of things.
Scott, work on your pathway to success and implementation, and then we'll do another program on this.
Okay, doc.
But you can't leave it with nonsense. You gotta follow all the technical and the academic and the possibilities and the exciting and the inspiration with a pathway to fruition. That's your job. You figure it out.
Well, I'm an engineer and a historian, so.
Well, you can, that doesn't mean anything. You can figure it out. That you're not barred from creative pathways by being an engineer and a historian.
Yeah, mostly my creative paths involve yelling at people and
Well, don't limit yourself, but you've got another space show date available when you when you've got a proposed pathway to so that we can go through this all again, and then we're left with a way into the future.
Okay. Well, one last thing. Blatant self-promotion. AerospaceProjectsReview.com.
That's your website?
Yeah, it's one word. AerospaceProjectsReview.com.
So what do? Do you review aerospace projects for people?
Yeah, essentially, yes.
So you're a consultant.
Aerospace history stuff. Although there is a link on there to, something relevant. I'm slowly working on an alternate history science fiction thing where the Cuban Missile Crisis goes a little different, with the end result being that the United States develops the deep space bombardment system based on Orion. So by the 1980s, the United States is flying around the inner solar system in Orion ships.
Cool. All right, my friend.
All right.
I'll get the archives to you as soon as possible, and I'll look forward to that next show with your pathway to the future.
All righty.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Listeners, thank you for participating in today's program. Goodbye, all, from the space show.